This is a message for those that work in manufacturing across the UK and Ireland.
Do your engineering maintenance doors keep you awake at night? Are your engineers spending excessive time sourcing and finding the spare parts they need?
Eric's on-site teams take responsibility for your indirect supply chain, including both your MRO procurement and inventory control. And, as the name suggests, we do this while being based on your site. For more information, visit www.erics.co.uk/EM.
Bushfire season is a natural part of the Australian annual cycle. Although a misnomer, the dry months fall at different parts of the year depending on the region. For thousands of years, these grass and shrub fires have erupted and died away, bringing balance.
But year upon year, changes in the climate have nudged and then jolted this most delicate of natural phenomena.
Until the events of Black Summer, the bushfire season of 2019-20. The fires burned for months, and in addition to the 33 lives, it consumed 17 million hectares of vegetation and killed or displaced over 3 billion animals, according to a World Wildlife Fund Australia study. It was the worst wildlife disaster in modern history.
According to a study, 810 priority species and ecosystems have been identified for urgent intervention to avoid extinction, at an eye-watering potential cost of $16 billion per year for 30 years. This would save 65% of the species, while achieving 95% would cost $73 billion per year for the same period.
Interested listeners can find a link to this report in the show notes, because the scale of this disaster is critical to showing that Australia is on the front lines of climate change, much more so than other developed nations.
In the years since, the traditionally coal-powered southern continent has adopted some of the most ambitious targets for new renewables generation. But renewables bring a new set of challenges that Australia has not intended to face before, and ambition needs to be aligned with realism.
Welcome to Engineering Matters. I'm Johnny Dowling.
And I'm Rhian Owen.
This week, we've partnered with Atkins Realis to look at the issue of intermittency in a country making a rapid shift away from fossil fuels and towards a renewables-heavy grid.
Australia is often seen as a unique test case for a developed nation, one uniquely affected by the impacts of climate change. Many eyes are on the southern continent.
So first, we need to understand a little more about the rare situation Australia is in.
My name's Tom Hesker. I'm the CEO of Atkins Realis, Australia and New Zealand.
Tom became CEO for the region in 2021, just as everything in the country's energy ambitions began to change.
We're very excited about supporting the government, the federal government, as well as the state governments in this transition.
In 2022, Australia passed the Climate Change Act, doubling the target for emission reductions by 2030 and setting the goal of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. Within the various authorities and frameworks sits an interim target for 82% of electricity generation to be from renewable resources by 2030.
That's up from 27% in early 2023, according to the International Energy Authority. Much more than a doubling within the decade. To achieve this, the country's capacity investment scheme aims to deliver an additional 32 gigawatts of installed capacity by 2030.
It's certainly a challenging target to achieve the aspirations. And we're really starting to see a lot of the larger infrastructure projects in order to enable that transition coming to market at the moment.
This in itself is an interesting challenge for Australia, which has traditionally focused on coal.
This was a very cheap and long-term solution that's been working well in Australia for a long time. We've got an industry that's established to support that, which is more around maintaining the assets and infrastructure that we invested in a long, long time ago. Now we're looking to restructure the grid around clean energy generation, and that is requiring us to establish clean energy generation zones.
The government is having to invest in trunk infrastructure to bring that energy back to the grid, while the industry is having to switch from delivering projects worth in the tens or low hundreds of millions of dollars to having to think about $5 billion mega projects, a completely different level of complexity.
So this is another area that that is only making this transition more complex, and it's another challenge that everyone who operates within the industry is having to play their role in.
The biggest change from a coal-powered electricity grid to one run on renewables is the issue of intermittency. Australia is blessed with sun-soaked landscapes and long, windy coastlines. But there will be times that demand outstrips supply, when the sun does not shine and the wind does not blow, at least not enough.
Grid resilience can cover intermittency with firm power such as nuclear or through interconnection to neighbouring grids. Unlike the diverse grids of the Western European or North American nations, for example, Australia has access to neither. It also has recent experience with mass power cuts, which its population will not tolerate.
Coal plants are reliable and quick to fire up. But in a world shifting away from coal, Australia needs to find a way to compensate for this loss of reliability. Its only option is storage. Storage, that is, at grid scale. And while battery technology is improving, the worldwide transition to renewables has shunted a long-established technology into a position of never-before-seen importance.
Pumped storage?
It solves an issue that probably was not there 5-10 years ago.
This is Sebastian Musso, global leader of power and renewables in Atkins Realis. His native Canada is one of the countries most blessed with hydropower potential and capacity. But even in the Great White North, pumped storage has historically not really been needed.
The fact that we've used hydro more for generation, so it was producing energy. Pump hydro is negative energy. It will not produce energy. It's going to produce power, but it's going to allow us to do storage. Why do we need storage? Well, it's because we're implementing so much renewable on the grid right now that is intermittent. We need to have ways to kind of put power in the grid when there is no wind blowing or when there is no sun happening there. Renewable is putting a complexity in the grid that we didn't have 10 years ago.
Although battery developments may be firmly in the public consciousness, for those with a passing familiarity with the benefits of tunnelling and underground construction, pump storage has always been the darling of the energy storage space.
It has a number of advantages.
One is round-trip efficiency, which in a pump storage you can get close to, I would say, 80%.
This is Vinod Bhatta, global lead for hydro and pumped hydro within Atkins Realis, also based in Canada, but originally from India.
Another thing is the grid scale, because you see, when we talk of storage is normally you need it not only just the power or megawatts, but how many hours you can store it for, right? And how you discharge it and what is the flexibility on it.
So often, startup companies and battery advocates boast of power while ignoring energy. Watts, not watt hours or joules. A storage device could power Sydney or Toronto for a few seconds, boasting an impressive wattage, but fail as a serious grid storage.
Pumped storage involves the active pumping of water from a lower reservoir to a higher reservoir over time, while energy is cheap and then releasing it as needed. It can provide gigawatts of power for hours, days at a time.
Most markets look at 8-hour coverage, but Australia is looking at a full 24-hour supply.
This kind of storage also does not worry about degradation. Batteries lose capacity over time, while tunnels and hydropower have working lives in the centuries. However, in traditional ROI calculations, which look at 30 to 40-year periods, this is not accounted for.
The problem is that we evaluate our return on investment based on a period of 30 to 40 years. hydro has been there for 100 years. I'm working right now on plants that have been operating for more than 100 years and are still operating. You won't find any other technologies right now that you can say that's going to go above 50 years.
This was not the only obstacle to pumped storage in the past. Although we've not had the intermittency problem for very long, and that is a key benefit making pumped storage so urgent right now, there are other ancillary benefits to pumped storage projects that the market has failed to value historically.
And that's what I've been kind of advocating for many years now, is that a pumped hydro, what they are looking at, earlier people are looking at arbitrage only, means that you use energy in a pumped hydro project when it is cheaper, and then you supply it when the energy rates are higher. So difference, that's where you make money. But pumped hydro projects cannot be viable just based on that arbitrage. It's very difficult.
The economics of that are simply not sufficient to justify the expense of the project.
Pumped hydro projects have several what we call as ancillary benefits. You know, quick start is for one of them, for example, black start. You know, then it provides additional inertia to the system because we have a rotor, you know, which is rotating in the grid. And for the grid frequency, that inertia is very important.
This and other electrical benefits have failed to be valued, and a price mechanism has never been developed.
My experience is that governments and other people push work only when they're pushed to the wall. And that's what probably we are waiting, or they are waiting for a eureka moment.
A eureka moment where some technology solves the problem for us.
But they will be pushed right now. I think we are losing time. Net zero targets are in front of us. So much renewables have become so cheap. Solar is like at, you know, 3 cents or 2 cents per kilowatt hour. It's really, really cheap. And with so much penetration of solar and wind, I think they will have no choice but to put grid-scale storage. And then everyone will scramble to put one.
So what is the potential for pumped storage in Australia? In the modern context, pumped storage does not actually need to be attached to a hydropower project. And many defunct mining sites are attractive. Surely development will be forthcoming.
Well, it's not just surely. They are building right now some projects. Snowy Hydro is in construction, Kitston is in. Mm-hmm. So there are projects that are being built right now. And so many other projects that are at the stage of, well, studies or engineering or getting kind of the financial close of these projects. So it's happening. It's a reality already. So question is, how many are we going to build? I don't have the answer. But it's going to be more than two or three, but it won't be 50 pump hydro. So it's going to be probably between 5 and 15 pump hydro for Australia. Large pump hydro scheme.
These can be anything from 500 megawatts up to 2,000 megawatts apiece.
Pump storage is a very compelling long-duration storage solution. I think that there has been some challenges recently with the evolution of long-duration battery storage with battery energy storage schemes. I think as technology progresses in that field, it will put some pressure on the pumped hydro energy storage industry. Within the context of Australia, it's important that energy storage solution is adjacent to clean energy generation in the form of wind or solar. And that has been taken into consideration when the renewable energy zones have been identified by the state and federal governments within Australia. So there is opportunity for pumped hydro energy storage, and I think I'm confident that the market will take up that opportunity.
Tom doesn't see an Australia blanketed with pumped hydro schemes, although a great many are being contemplated at the moment. He expects that they'll be confined to identified clean energy zones.
So my view is that there's potential for, I suppose, 4 to 5 pumped hydro schemes to get up in Australia within this current cycle. But there's certainly more than that in the market at the moment. To some extent, that'll also depend on the mix of other energy, long-duration energy storage solutions.
Industry needs to respond to this growth in project scale and the sudden ramping up of investment. In Canada, with its century plus of experience in hydro and pumped storage, conversations with potential project owners and investors are very different to those currently underway in Australia.
But you need to work in a way where they're going to be part about your technical decision. In Australia right now, there is a lack of experience with that. We need to do a little bit more of teaching or education with them to try to guide them. So it's a different approach for us, but I really like that.
Prior to his current role, if you hadn't guessed it, Sebastian was a professor. He adds that the Australian project owners were interested in Canadian experience in integrating engineering and construction, constructability, along with some other new approaches, such as heavy lifting helicopters being used on site.
But ultimately, this transition is in progress. It is happening one way or another, and Australia is taking the responsible approach to pair renewables with grid storage.
It's not just the structure of a new renewable energy industry that Australia must contend with. It has entered into a global race, one that many countries do not yet realise they've entered.
A race to generate and attract engineering talent. Australian industry, if not perhaps its populace and policymakers, has embraced the sheer scale of the challenge facing it.
And I think the question that I've raised about the pace that they will build it is something important, because the government has really, really set the target super high. Is it feasible? Is it possible? Do we have, say, we also have to think about someone has to build that. That's one thing to say we're going to have the money for it and we're going to do it, but who are the contractors? Who are the engineers that's going to make that a reality?
To be clear, this is not a problem facing only Australia. And Sebastian says that the energy transition will run into a bottleneck, the human component.
Well, I cannot talk for all countries, but I can talk for, say, I'm living in Canada. I'm in the province of Quebec. Quebec needs 60,000 more engineers. We have to double within 10 years our engineers. And it's just in the province of around 10 million people. And I'm sure that when you go in other countries, the demography is not good. And the needs for all these infrastructure are just growing. So we're going to need more engineers. What are we doing about that? We need more contractors. We need more engineers.
So we need engineers. But why enter the energy sector?
So I think the energy sector globally is probably one of the fastest evolving industries. And I'm not just talking about the industry supporting the physical environment around constructing these assets. I'm talking around funding, ownership, technology, as well as engineering around construction and building physical infrastructure. So as we work to decarbonize our generation sources, we're also looking to transition things like cars and mobility to clean energy sources. We're looking to transition manufacturing and heavy industry to clean energy sources.
It's a broad interconnecting array of industries and disciplines.
So I guess if I was talking to my own children about industries that fundamentally are going to have to transform themselves and have scope for tremendous growth, I can't see how the energy industry is can't be considered probably one of the greatest opportunities in that space. So I guess it excites me and about the role that our organisation can play. It excites me also about the opportunities that this will provide our teams to be able to develop and enjoy through supporting the infrastructure rollout.
You never do twice the same thing. It's always a prototype that we're building. There is no hydro scheme or dam in the world that is similar to another one. It's always a new project. So there is no, I haven't seen in my career twice doing the same thing. So all the caverns, the tunneling, the rivers, the water, the turbines, the equipment is always different. So, and we also work, I'm going to say, a little bit outside of usual codes. What's a power station? It's not a building. It's not a train station. It's something different. So we are always at the edge and the boundary of research. I did super complex stuff that I would never have the opportunity to do in another sector. So for me, as an engineer to not do twice the same thing, to be at the kind of the edge of research and developing new technologies, for me was super attractive. So, and it's also right now in 2024, we value so much these kind of projects that kind of are aligned with the agenda around decarbonization. And working in that space, well, you have a feeling that you can make a difference somewhere. So it's super attractive, I think, for young engineers to work there.
Engineering Matters is a production of Rebe Media. This episode was written and produced by Alex Conacher, edited by Will North. Your hosts were me, Johnny Dowling, and Rian Owen. Sound engineering by Ross McPherson. Series supervision by John Young. And our own abundant upper reservoir is Rory Harris. Special thanks to our episode partner, Atkins Realis, and thank you for listening. You can find Engineering Matters on all podcast apps, on our website, engineeringmatters.rebe.media, and on LinkedIn.